when you move from the northeast to the southeast, this is what happens to your bank balance. What did you think happened down here? It's like I was paying £500 a month in rent up in the northeast. Not paying that now. I'm paying that a week.
It's mad.
Oh. and you know what didn't go up four times? My salary.
Your salary. Welcome to another episode of Black in a Box. The world as told by black faces in white spaces.
She got it first time.
Beautiful black faces. Well, yes, yes, yes. Thank you. So the voice that you're hearing is obviously Alana. Dan had some business to take care of, so he is not going to be joining us. And Angelo will be joining us shortly. But, you know, Angelo's constant battle with TFL is never ending.
Living in Sussex will do that to you.
Yeah. In Mordor. Living in Mordor will do that. But we do have with us...
Hello, everyone. I'm always here. I think I'm the only person that's never missed an episode. So,
okay.
The day that I do miss one.
Okay.
How are we doing, Alana? You all good?
I am very good. I am very good. Thank you. Thank you. And we are joined by our wonderful guest, the Iron Empress herself, Miss Donna McConnell.
Hello.
How are we doing?
Hello. Hello.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Hope you got a lot of tape because I've got stories.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We are kings and queens of the long form, aren't we? So
keeping it rolling. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The trick is going to be to like reel it in, to be honest.
Yeah, that's a difficulty we always have.
Yeah.
How did you two actually meet? I've not even asked that question yet.
We met.
Just.
I don't know if I met you before the event. I don't think I did.
In the trenches. Yeah. I think maybe we already knew each other on social media.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But essentially, last year, as our listeners will remember, was training for my first Ironman. And as a part of that training, I joined a group called 10 Iron Women, which I'm sure we'll get into. Mm-hmm. But they're an amazing network of women who specifically train for Ironman, who are trying to get a more even balance between men and women into the sport and into the event. And then Donna was a part of that group, but I also feel like there was probably crossover with some running clubs and other cycling clubs, because I think you also know like Dora Atom and the Run-Dem crew. And
yeah, I mean, my association with Run-Dem and Run-Im was quite brief, but I know I've known Charlie for years. He used to do music as well. And Dora, I am part of her Ultra Black running club.
Yes.
But I've never actually made it to a run because I'm all cycling.
Yeah, okay. But I do think that the Ultra Black, and shout out Ultra Black, UBR, they're doing amazing things. They got me into the London Marathon this year, so that'll be
amazing.
Good. Thanks. But yeah, I think that's where the name started to circulate, and then officially met at one of the events while we were training for Barcelona last year. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What a madness that was. I love how casually you said that you got into London Marathon as well. Like that's an achievement in itself. How are you feeling for it?
I know. Well, we were just talking, Donna and I were just talking about how I took a quite significant break after my Ironman. I was like, I don't have to do anything anymore. I have not been training.
How long do you have?
2 months.
2 months. Well, yeah. Here's the thing. Yeah. I'm a fitness instructor, so I'm in terms of cardiovascular fitness.
Blow your trumpet, man.
I am. Thank you.
Do it.
We'll add an effect there.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm not starting from zero. And in terms of like mentally the time that it's going to take, that I feel like after the Ironman is no problem. Mm. Like I remember being in the cycle for the Ironman and being like, oh, a marathon's going to seem like nothing compared to something that is like four times as long now. So yeah, I think like mentally I'm there, but I just, I'm trying not to get injured. I'm trying not to overtrain. So if I have to run, walk it and just enjoy the vibes, like I'm more there for the experience than a time or anything like that. Yeah. Have you, I know you're more of a cyclist, which we'll get into, but have you been interested in doing any marathons, any run events specifically?
I'd like to do London Marathon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I actually was on the course, was it last year? Might have been last year, and you know, saw people doing it. And I thought, yeah, I'd like to do the marathon in my home city.
Mm.
But I had no interest before Ironman in doing anything that long.
Yeah.
As far as running was concerned. But I'd like to do that one.
Nice.
Maybe another one abroad.
Yeah.
But if I can injury proof my legs as well, because my joints don't generally love the running part as much.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's not fun.
Yeah, I'm feeling that now. And you've been experiencing that with your foray into running as well.
A little bit. It sounds a bit mad. I mean, everyone has to start somewhere, don't they? And I did my first half marathon last year, which it still feels a bit wild that I've got to the stage where I can run a half marathon, because for years I was just so anti-running. I got into cycling myself over the pandemic, just like everybody else did. And then it was my dear fiance that basically, she actually tried to get me to do couch to 5K, and my ego was like, I don't need no couch to 5K. So I went out to run a 5K and realized that I probably did need couch to 5K. I remember trying to like sprint the first kilometer and being like, yo, these people are crazy. So yeah, that was a lot. But like, honestly, I always said I'd never do a marathon. Hearing it right here, right now, I think I might at some stage, because it always seemed like something that was so unattainable to me.
Mm.
And I'm just seeing regular people become superheroes on the regular now.
That's right.
Which is unbelievable.
We are regular people.
100%.
And we've done it, you know.
It's so impressive. So impressive. That's the thing. It seems more attainable now. Because I used to think it was like middle class white blokes who have their little run groups. I know that there is still that perception, isn't there? But it is seeing people that look like me go and do it. It makes it seem so much more attainable and actually enjoyable as well, because I always used to think it was masochistic. I get it now. I do get it. So big up to you lot.
Yeah. Thanks. So before we get ahead of ourselves, you are the Iron Empress, but what was the journey to that point, to the Ironman, to the cycling? It's that classic. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Wow. It's a long journey. I mean, I always liked riding bikes from when I was a kid, but I never had a bike until I was 18. And, you know, I just rode around the block with my friends, and a lot of my friends were boys, so they had BMXs and, you know, the hot bikes at the time, the grifters, the choppers. Mm. And, you know, we did a lot of sport, roller skating, street hockey, just football, everything, you know, whatever sport was going, we did it. I mean, I grew up in the 70s. I was a teenager in the 80s. So you were outside all the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, somebody offered me a bike when I was 18. I bought a Muddy Fox for 50 quid. It was a 300 pound bike at the time. So I'll leave you to make up your minds of what happened there. And I just used to ride it. And at the time I was doing music, and I was aspiring rapper, and I was in a group with a couple of girls. One of them was a girl called Allison, who's also known as Betty Boo.
Okay.
And I used to ride to the studio. You know, we just use our bikes as transport, but I always kept a bike, and for that I was really unusual among my friends because nobody else rode. But I always had a bike, and I just used it for my errands, and then I used it for fitness. And I had my daughter when I was 24, and I went to university probably like a year and a half later. And when I was on the internet, this new thing called the internet that I'd not used. I was, 26 at the time. I'd never used the internet before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd used a computer, but this was new. One of the first things I saw on there was a page about triathlon.
Okay.
Interesting.
And I thought, oh, that looks really badass. I want to try that one day.
Mm.
20 years later, 20 years later, I finally decided to sign up for the London Triathlon. I actually signed up for it the year before and then bottled it. And then the next year I signed up for it, and I trained for it. Just got a plan off the internet. Mm. Mm-hmm. So this is like the really short abridged version, and did it. And I found the swimming really difficult because I'm just like the most average swimmer going. And I was like, oh my God, how am I going to, you know, swim this distance, this huge distance, 750 meters. Mm. But I just kept at it and I just kept ticking off the sessions and I had to swim in open water. But I had been surfing maybe a couple years earlier.
Yeah.
And spent quite a lot of time in the water when we were in Morocco. And it was really lovely, really beautiful. Mm. And Point Break was one of my favorite films.
Really?
With Keanu Reeves. Yeah, yeah. It's one of my favorite
and,
films.
And
Patrick Swayze.
Patrick Swayze. Yes.
So I was having a proper Point Break moment. Yeah. I was in the water. I didn't really stand up that much, but you had to swim out quite deep.
Yeah.
So you were in the water for hours every day for the week. So I felt quite comfortable. So even though I didn't do any open water training for that first triathlon, mentally, I felt like I would be okay. Mm. And I was. Mm. And just the feeling of when I completed it, it was so amazing. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really felt that feeling for a very, very long time, you know, because when you're a kid, you're competitive.
Yeah.
We played mm-hmm. team sports and stuff. I hadn't done that sort of thing for ages.
Yeah.
I hadn't entered any running races because I didn't want to. I just really went gym, boxing classes. You know, I kept fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that feeling was really good. And I was like, okay, I feel like I might want to do this again.
Yeah.
You know? And maybe a year or so later, a friend of mine got a group of us together to do Tough Mudder.
Oh, fun.
Yeah.
I actually love Tough Mudder. I've done it once, yeah.
Yeah, my friend got a big group of us together. Some of us knew each other, but most of us were just meeting at the training sessions, and we would train once a week down at Primrose Hill. Mm-hmm. We did the full Tough Mudder, got quite fit doing that. Then we did a couple of Spartans. And I was like, oh, there's way too much running in this. I'm gonna go back to triathlon. And then I think I saw 10 Iron Women on Instagram mm-hmm. and started following their journey as they trained to do the full distance Ironman. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, oh, that looks really good. I'd really like to do that one day. And I was approaching my 50th birthday. And
amazing.
I just thought, if not now, when? I mean, mm-hmm. I can't leave it another 20 years, can I? If I want to do it, I should just do it. So they put out a call on Instagram for women who wanted to do it to join the community. And that was it. I joined the community and I started group cycling. And I hadn't done any group cycling before. I'd just ridden my bike in London.
Yeah.
So I went with them on a ride to Brighton. That was my first long ride. Up until that point, I'd done like 40 kilometers across London. You know, I was really, really nervous. So it's not like I thought, oh yeah, I'm going to smash this. I was shitting myself.
Yeah, it's a big old ride.
I was going to say, like, what?
I was crying before I even got out of London. Do you know what I mean? Like from the little rollers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was finished. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But they were really, really encouraging, and you know, they got me there. When I got to Ditchling Beacon, as soon as the road started rising, I was off the bike.
Yeah,
like, okay, mm-hmm. I'm not making. Luckily, I had the gravel cleats then. I can't remember what you call them now, mm-hmm. and so I could walk up the hill, but I had to walk it. But after I did it, I felt amazing, and I was hooked. Thought, right, I definitely need to do more of this group cycling stuff. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine told me about a Black Cyclist Network that they were doing group cycling at Regent's Park, and I joined their sessions, and yeah, the door kind of opened to this whole new world of cycling that I had no experience of. You know, lived in London all my life, didn't know about cycling clubs.
Yeah.
The first time I'd seen women ride bikes professionally was 2012 Olympics.
Really?
And I was like, you could do this for a living. That was news to me. Like, I'd never seen women riding road bikes. I didn't know anybody that rode a road bike.
Yeah.
And I got my first road bike around 2004 just on a whim because I saw J-Lo in a video.
Which video was it?
She did a parody. I think it's called So Good.
Okay.
Yeah. Feel So Good. She did a parody of Flashdance.
Right.
And yes, so she was
this video.
Jennifer yes. Beals' character. Yes, she had this yes. really cool retro road bike. And I thought, oh, that's really cool. So I went on eBay and I bought a old rally road bike for £50. I needed it anyway to ride to uni for I was doing my postgrad in Islington. And the tube fares had gone up ridiculously. So I was like, right, I'm going to ride there. And I really liked that. I loved how it felt. It was faster. So when I got a job as a journalist working for a newspaper, you know, cycle to work scheme, upgraded, got to specialise. Then I got a Trek. Then I got a Cannondale. Just, you know, I just kept upgrading my bike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I decided I wanted to do triathlons, I got the Cannondale, but I actually bought it a size too big. So that was then, just as I was training for Ironman in 2021.
Yeah.
Or 20. So then I had to upgrade it, but obviously pandemic.
Right.
And everybody was buying up all the bikes.
Yes, yes.
So
right. Yeah, me.
So all
too.
The mid, you know, all the like the me mid too. Price bikes
yeah.
gone.
Yeah.
So I ended up buying a bike that was a lot more expensive than I ever planned to spend on a bike.
Well, that's smart of you because I got the cheapest option that was available and I
did the same thing.
Felt it.
I got a bike race. And I genuinely had to upgrade it after about, I'm not even joking, about 6 months because I just went in, like, just get me the first bike that's available in my size. And I think it was, before the end of that summer, I was like, I need to upgrade again.
Yeah, it was where you had to like pre-order everything, yeah. right? And then you'd pick it up like 2 months later or whatever.
I couldn't believe how expensive it is. Like, I mean, when you properly get into your cycling, like those prices are mad. Absolutely mad.
But you know, there are ways to do it cheaper, and I think like people that really are into bikes, they won't buy like a whole bike from a shop. They'll buy a frame and put the parts together. So that's like the next level. Once you sort of are in it and you start to understand it, and it's like, okay, well, I don't need to buy all of this stuff that really and truly is overpriced. Just buy a frame.
I guess, and it's like a car, right, isn't it? Similar kind of thing.
Put the parts together.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was really offended when I realised that the wheels that you get with your bike are rubbish.
And yeah.
you need to spend money on... I'm like, I just paid how much for this bike? I got to spend more on wheels?
And then the wheels are more than the bike.
What?
If you get
The wheels cost more than some frames.
Proper race wheels.
Oh, my days.
They're... Each wheel is like the cost of, well, my bike, my shitty little bike.
There's someone that cycled a lot during lockdown. I was glad that I had a B-twin, but it was, I love cycling. Every great bike I've ever had has been stolen. That's kind of like a cost of doing business, living up in Yorkshire like I was. You may have already discussed this, but like one of the things that really saved me, I was living by myself during lockdown and, you know, they were like, you can go out once a day.
Yeah.
So I would just go out into the Yorkshire Wolds and I'd be like, I'm going out once a day for 9 hours. And I would do like, but the thing is, I wasn't even doing it to keep fit. I was doing it because I was like, I've got nothing else to do.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know if you've ever cycled up in the Yorkshire Wolds.
No, I was saying I want to.
The beauty of it is that even outside of lockdown, you might see 40 people on your entire like 7-8 hour bike ride.
That's amazing.
Like it wasn't a 7-8 hour bike ride, but you stretch out. It's like, yeah, I will take that extra hill. I wondered if you've talked about like the mental health benefits of cycling and how you kind of help people overcome that. But I don't know the right lycra. I don't know the right shoes. I haven't got the right bike. How do you help people sort of overcome that? Because I just did it by myself because I was like, ain't nobody else out on these roads.
So. Yeah.
I mean, my DMs are always open. I learnt from other people initially, you know, and people sort of told me that, well, yeah, cycling stuff can be expensive, but buy the winter stuff in summer and the summer stuff in winter. But I do always say to people, like, you should, don't worry about what you're wearing, just wear what you feel comfortable in.
Yeah.
Because you have to know if you're going to like it first, you know? And I wish people wouldn't stress so much about the clothes and stuff, because it's like any sort of clothing. Obviously, cycling clothes are technical, but what are you doing with your cycling? What kind of cycling are you doing? Because if you're not racing or you're not planning to do endurance events, you don't really need to be thinking about spending lots of money on your clothes. You know, if you're not planning to cycle, you know, 3 or 4 times a week, you just don't need to. You just need one good set of clothes. A waterproof jacket is really important. And obviously a helmet's really important. A base layer. I was thinking about this just the other day. A base layer is really important.
Yeah.
You know, because you want to be warm and you want to be dry. And, you know, the rest you can just keep very simple and basic until you decide what level you want to be doing your cycling at.
I think that was one of the things that, if I can speak from a personal standpoint, really grabbed my attention with you being in the chat and being so present on Instagram, is that you were so available to people like me who had these questions. Like, I'm the crazy person who's like, my first triathlon is basically Ironman that I was training for. I didn't know what kit to get, but more than that, like, I just didn't know how to approach this sport that seemed very distant from me. Again, seemed very like white male middle class and people who had money, and I was like, well, I really want to accomplish this thing and I think that my body is up to it, but it's expensive. And I feel like you really helped in saying you don't have to do this and you can do this. This is hype, this is blah blah blah, like here are the basics. And I think just having that resource and that community to lean on and to help you sort of address those barriers was so helpful. And I wanted to touch on that as well, because you seem to be quite get up and go, like self-motivated. But then you've also mentioned a lot of the different communities that you've been involved with in terms of sport. And can you just speak to, you know, what was important about being involved in communities for you? And then also, did you always feel like you belonged into the spaces that you entered, or what was your experience?
No.
Okay.
I just think it's just really normal for us as Black people to just feel like the outsiders.
Yeah.
I never really felt in all the spaces that I've been in that I've belonged, even the spaces where it's all Black people, you know, or majority Black people, because we're just really individual, aren't we? I don't think, even if the sport is the thing that connects you, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to connect with the people that are doing it.
Yeah,
it just is just how it is, you know. And I think I was quite lucky when I came into the whole group cycling thing, because there were Black cyclists there already sort of established, doing it, organizing it. That's the point that I came in at. I never knew about cycling clubs before that. I was just doing life and doing my life. So I'm not even going to say it's their fault that I didn't know about it. It just wasn't a thing for me. It wasn't a focus for me. So, but when I needed the cycling clubs, the Black cyclists were already there. And then the pandemic happened and even more Black cyclists came. You know, I knew about Rafa, but there wasn't really any sort of pull for me to join a club where I would be in a minority like that. And, you know, I worked as a journalist and editor in national newspapers. I was always the minority on the team. So I just felt very strongly like, in my spare time, I don't want to go and join clubs where I'm in the minority and feeling awkward in my free time. You know, so I just think I was very lucky at the point where I was ready to join groups that the Black cyclists were there. Obviously, I joined 10 Iron Women, but again, I was a minority in that group. But we had the goal of training for the Ironman in common. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that's what kind of bonded us. And,
yeah,
you know, girls like Elena were so encouraging mm-hmm. to me. I don't think I necessarily would have got as far in my cycling journey if she hadn't pushed me initially at the time when mm-hmm. I was struggling, you know, when I was finding it really, really difficult. But I think everybody... Well, I know for myself, I can only speak for myself, but yeah, there was a part of me that wanted to belong to like a sport community. I'd mm-hmm. trained on my own for so many years, mm-hmm. you know, never really found my people in terms of, you know, people to do fitness with and stuff. Mm-hmm. I did, I was with Random initially in the beginning because I knew Charlie invited me to come, but running wasn't really my thing. Mm-hmm. I do like to do different things. And that's what I like about triathlon is the fact that, you know, it's more than one sport mm-hmm. and, you know, there's room to get better in each of them
yeah.
or get worse in my case, I thought. Yeah. So I kind of like that variety, mm-hmm. but yeah, finding the cycling community has definitely, I do feel like I fit there.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of how much I enjoy cycling and just, you know, what goes with it. The people that I've met, you know, riding with Chain Gang Cyclists now. I've been with them for 2 years and, you know, they definitely feel like my people. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I started doing rides with them, I felt very much at home. And that's kind of the club motto, feels like home. Mm-hmm. And it did, because they're people that I don't really have to explain myself yeah. to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We have stuff in common, just, you know, culturally and just naturally. And that's what I want, you know, for my fitness community.
And I think the community part is key, and where you don't have to explain yourself and it does feel like home. And I think specifically the pandemic, like for you, Jello, and for you, and probably you as well, Dom, and definitely for me, there was something about being so isolated that our only excuse to get outside was to do something physical. Mm. But then in doing something physical, it opened us up to wanting to have more of a sense of community. So then I think there was, I don't know the stats on this, but I feel intuitively that there was a huge rise in clubs and groups that would get together. So running clubs, hiking clubs, that's how I found Ultra Black Running, shout out Dora. And then through that found 10 Iron Women. And it just, there was this network that just sprung up of clubs and communities for Black people centered around fitness and well-being. And then also for Black women specifically. So I think that was just like one of the great things to come out of the pandemic and the relationship there between that isolation and then really craving a sense of community.
And I was just really glad to see that, you know, so many Black people started to become more and more active mm-hmm. because of the pandemic
yeah.
and have kept it up afterwards as well. You know, some yeah. people form clubs at the time and they're still going strong. You know, and my cycling club formed during a pandemic as well. And it's just amazing to see the journey that some of the people have had, like people starting on mountain bikes, riding in football shirts and Air Force Ones. And
I feel very seen.
Who is exposed in his room?
I'll tell you yeah. what, I had to do it though, because and this might have changed a little bit now, but when I first started cycling, and I've been slack for the last year or so, but when I first started cycling, I got to the point where I was like, I'm going to get the gear. I want to look like I know what I'm doing, even if I don't fully know what I'm doing.
I remember the Lycra.
I got so embarrassed. I remember going on and being like, well, I'm an XL. Let me buy an XL on this unnamed brand. I couldn't even get it over my head. I was like, please yeah. align your clothing sizes with other yeah. brands, because
that
it's
a massive
crazy.
Problem.
That's I had to get a 4XL. It's mental.
It is the size is a problem.
You laugh too hard.
I didn't say nothing.
Look, I got a 62 centimeter frame, so like I'm tall as well.
It is a barrier to cycling. I remember initially I didn't want to wear the Lycra stuff. I just thought it looked really geeky.
Yeah.
I didn't think it looked cool at all.
Now she's got her her Rafa on.
Yeah, and then you know I've evolved.
Yeah. It's when you have those padded shorts for the first time. You're like, I didn't know that life could be this comfortable.
When I first put a bib on, though, I was walking around the house, like, just checking myself out.
I saw in an interview that you said there was a point in your life where you'd started the triathlons and then you lost your job. But because you had the triathlons, it gave you the confidence to not just look for the same jobs, but to push further and to go for jobs that were worth money and to not sell yourself short. Do you think that was because you were feeling... Well, could you talk us through what it was about this stuff that you were doing with the fitness that changed your mental mindset?
Well, doing an Ironman is just a huge undertaking. It's not even just about the race day. It's 6 months of training, 2 sessions a day for 6 months. Yeah. And
at least 6 months. Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough. You push yourself to... You just take yourself to a new zone. And I think as humans, you can either just get comfortable where you are, or you're the type of person that wants to keep evolving, keep pushing yourself. But I definitely felt like I took myself to a different place as Donna. And it gave me a lot of confidence at a time when I think I was probably feeling a bit uncertain about myself, about life, about my future. You know, you're approaching 50, you're a woman of a certain age, you start to experiencing the change, menopause starts to enter the chat, hormones start to leave the chat.
For me, yeah.
So it just gave me a lot of confidence and I just thought, no, you know, you're not going to sell yourself short. You're going to think like a man. You're going to think like a mediocre man. You're going to ask for more. You're going to try, even if the job description looks a bit, you know, like maybe you've only got 50%. You're still going to apply if it's 50% of what you want. Yeah, just doing that just gave me so much zest. And so you know, I realized I still had that grit that I had when I was younger, that determination, that stubbornness to not be defeated by things.
Where do you think that came from?
I do think that partly you're born with it, and you know, it's genetic. And I look at my family, and I look at, you know, my family are Jamaican. And I think, you know, if you look in your family lineage and the people that are in it, I think it definitely comes from my gran. My gran was like an amazingly strong Jamaican woman. She was born an orphan, and but, you know, she survived and she thrived, and she had 4 daughters. She brought them all here. She worked in the West End as a seamstress, and then she worked as a chef in a hotel. And she was just a doer, you know. She was just a go-getter, and she was worldly. She traveled, and she would tell me about stuff, and she gave me books on Black history, and she would take us to the theatre, and... She was just, I don't know, she was just so, I know strong is like an overused word when it comes to Black women, but she just really had this amazing drive, and she was a nutter. She was a bit of a nutter.
Big like, up to the grands who
you know,
are,
she was
a little
the
wild.
matriarch.
Yeah.
But she was just such a smart, strong, tenacious woman. And I definitely feel like she gave me a bit of that. And also, growing up in the 70s was, obviously, it is a long time ago, but you had to have some drive.
Yeah. Mm.
You had to have some determination because...
But did you grow up in the 70s?
Me.
I'm still blown away as well.
Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, I was born in 1969, so it was actually a time of real turbulence.
Producer Io is like, no.
I'm not gonna lie. When we were chatting about it in the group, I was like to Alana, you need to check if that's 50 Ironmans or if that is.
Yeah, I was like, it must be 50 races.
I'm trying to be professional here, but I'm like, you look younger than I do.
Stop it.
This is mad. Sorry.
No, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Growing up in the 70s, it was a time of turbulence because the Race Relations Act had only really just come into existence in, you know, in 1969, or was it 64? I'm not exactly sure. And so those kind of things, the racism, the systemic racism was still very much a problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Expectations were low for people like me in school. So you had to have some determination. I was very lucky as well. I had good parents. And my dad was very education focused. And he was like, yes, you know, you need to get education, you need to go to university, all of that. Any problems at school, he was down there, you know, he was always, you know, always had our back and stuff. And I also went to a really good primary school, which had a lot of liberal teachers. And it was quite heavily sort of, alongside the curriculum, they really sort of pushed art and music and theatre and stuff like that. And they really repped for the kids, you know. They were so passionate about the work. And obviously you had like a certain amount of kids that had behavioural problems, but they were really, really good at managing that sort of thing as well.
That's awesome.
So I think those kind of things really helped me to sort of see that I could progress in this world. So by the time I got to secondary school, I was like, okay, I know I'm bright. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know I can study. You know, I may not be the best, but I can do it.
Yeah.
And I just carried that through life, I think.
That's amazing. And once you achieve one feat, it must be easy to be like, okay, what's the next thing?
Yeah.
And what's the next thing? And then eventually you get to, I think I can do an Ironman at 50.
I think, you know, with the Ironman thing, it was just because I had done the sprint distance and I'd followed the training plan and I achieved it. In my mind, I just said, well, I just need to follow the training plan and just give it my best. Mm. And also, I'm not afraid to fail.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be embarrassed by failure because I'm not a professional athlete. I'm just an ordinary person who's doing this to just do something in life, you know. I want to stay fit. I want to stay healthy as I age. And I've already done like 40 years of gym and classes and running outside. I need something more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and this is it. And now with the cycling, I love the cycling so much. I want to do that longer. So I have to stay fit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have to go in the gym. I have to watch what I eat,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it makes it easier for me to go on in the bike and stay strong on the bike.
Yeah. Do what you love.
Yeah.
I just can't get over doing like the first Ironman around that, because I've had these conversations with my mum, coupled with the pandemic as well. She was finding it really difficult to get back into health and get back into fitness and those kind of things. Did those thoughts ever come into your mind when you were actually going to do, I know you were very fit your entire life anyway, but going to do your first challenge, your first huge challenge like that, did any of that kind of almost imposter syndrome like affect you?
I mean, obviously there's a fear that you might not make it, but with the whole menopause thing, I was quite fortunate that I wasn't really suffering with the symptoms too badly then. Plus, I was so active that I think it helped with the symptoms. I found that my symptoms were more of a problem last year because I felt more tired. I felt like I wasn't recovering as quickly. Mm. But that was probably a knock-on effect from the previous 2 years where I'd been super, super active at a time when maybe my hormones were like being more of a challenge for me. But yeah, at that time, I just was so on it that I didn't really notice the whole... It wasn't debilitating for me in that moment. But definitely before that, you know, I felt like my mood was quite low. And that's not like me. I'm not really a person that that kind of wallows. So I did go and see a therapist and I did some CBT stuff. And, you know, my daughter just encouraged me. My daughter's, you know, an adult. And, you know, she knows when I'm not feeling great. But she encouraged me to go out and do things that I wanted to do and you know, make new friends. She said, "Mom, you know, you can go out there, you can make new friends." And you know what? I pushed myself to do it. And I pushed myself to do new things. Because I think sometimes feeling low can come from when you feel like you're in a bit of a rut, you know, and you're just like treading the same path over and over again. And I'm definitely a person that doesn't really like routine, you know, or routine that's not satisfactory, you know. So I'll always try and change my circumstances. But yeah, it's important to listen to your body as well. And I definitely felt last year it was more of an issue for me with the whole menopause symptoms. So I just rested more, you know, I rested more. I looked into HRT, but ultimately I don't really think it's for me. I just didn't really feel like it.
HRT, sorry.
Hormone replacement therapy.
Yeah, I don't really feel it's for me. You know, I just don't, I'm very wary of taking things, starting to take things and then taking them for a long periods of time and the effect it has on your body. You know, I have looked into it, I have read it into it, I tried it, but I didn't really feel like it made a difference. And I'm not using it now and I feel absolutely fine. I go to bed early, I try to eat better, I exercise, and you know, I rest when I'm tired.
Love that recipe for life. Can we talk about music?
The music.
Absolutely. Because obviously,
you go.
I've got a treasure trove of questions, but we're gonna get into it in a second. But like, just we were talking about you growing up in the '70s and the '80s, and obviously British culture that was transported around the world, and what the entertainment that we kind of consumed in the UK around that time looked very different to towards the end of the '80s and into the '90s, etc. So I find it really, really interesting to hear stories and just understand what London in particular was like in those days when hip hop was in its real infancy and when it was way more exciting than I think it is now, personally. In the golden era. So I think I mentioned before we started recording, obviously, that I know Jello, you've also got this situation, certain family members that were also very much involved in the scene back in those days. So I know you spoke on the other podcast about a story with Public Enemy, but have you got any stories, anything that comes to mind? What were the real highlights of those days for yourself?
I think one of the great things about that time was if you really like the music, you could just get involved with it, you know. So a lot of us were really into the music. I started hearing electro probably when I was about 14, 15. And then when I started hearing, you know, the actual records and stuff, me and my friends just used to play it. They'd make me tapes and stuff. And then someone said to me, "Oh, there's a girl in your school and she's into the same music as well." And that's literally how we became friends.
Okay.
Like, "Oh, you like hip hop? Yeah. Oh, do you want to come over?" And and that was it, you know. And we just started listening to the music together. And we thought, yeah, we want to make our own music. And I think that was just the really cool thing about it, that it was this community where everybody wanted to make the music as well.
Yeah.
And we started going out to clubs and we met people who were also making music, like London Posse. They were one of the first groups that we met. And we met them at the Public Enemy concert. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like the thing that sort of changed the direction for us when we went to that concert.
Is that the Academy one?
Apollo. Well, it's not. It wasn't called Apollo then. Hammersmith. And that was just an amazing gig. Just sort of.
Yeah.
Just blew your mind. And I remember my friend Peter gave me their album on tape, and I was like, and I heard it. It just messed with my head.
Is that Fear of a Black Planet?
Yeah. It was just, no, it was before that, Yo Bum Rush the Show.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The first album.
Yeah.
And you just hadn't heard anything like it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I got to meet these guys. I got to meet them. And then when they did the show, we did meet them.
It's just not a thing just anymore, like is it?
No.
Yeah, but there was a hotel in Holland Park. It was a Hilton, so we thought, oh, they'll probably stay there. Went there, and they weren't there, but I met Rakim.
Oh.
He was there. He was very standoffish, which I think was quite cool.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, because, you know, when you're a girl and you're into hip hop at that time, obviously people just think, oh, you're a groupie.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, there were boys with us as well that evening. And met LL that night as well. I think that was the only time I met LL. And then we met a Griff and a couple of the S1Ws at the McDonald's. And we went on tour with them. We went around the UK and we did some shows in the US. What? So
amazing.
With
Public Enemy?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
And we went to this place called Delaware.
As the American, that's just what this place called Delaware. It's a whole state, but
is it a state?
Yeah.
It's quite nondescript.
Is it near Philadelphia?
It's kind of in between Philly DC. I've been to Delaware before.
Yeah. So we drove there, I guess, from Long Island in like a you know, there was like a few cars with Public Enemy, drove to do this. They went to do this gig. We did the gig and they did the gig as well. And Will Smith was there. That's where we met.
Wow.
Will Smith and Jazzy Jeff. I know I'm properly name dropping now.
No, but keep going.
You know, he hadn't really blown up then, but obviously if you were into hip hop, you knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, that's what it was like. It was just.
So was this late 80s?
This was, late 80s, like 87, 88.
Mm. So before he 88. Won, before he won the Grammy in Boycott.
Yeah. And they used to have this music seminar that a lot of the rappers would go to, and there'd be like an MC battle and stuff there. I think famously Roxanne Shanté entered that. So we used to go over for that. At that time, I think we were with a record company, Music of Life. So we got them to fly us out there.
Mm.
And I met this guy called JC. He was like A&I, worked with a record company, and he knew a lot of people. I met Jungle Brothers, Tribe Called Quest that time.
Amazing.
And De La Soul. Sort of met all those people around the same time.
So you were almost a native tongue.
Almost. Well, what's really interesting is I knew Moni Love really well. And when the Jungle Brothers came over to do a tour, they came with Queen Latifah and I think it's Chill Rob G, somebody like that. And I introduced her to the Jungle Brothers.
No way.
Yeah. I introduced her to the Jungle Brothers, and then she ended up, you know, making music with them, and then Tribe Called Quest and Latifah.
Yeah.
This is like full circle moment for me as well, because so my mom and my dad being a musician, he was back and forth between LA and New York. And my parents call this like their Westwood days in the 80s. So like in Westwood in LA, it was like a neighbor. It was like
UK listeners, very different.
Very, very different. Very different. And back then it was like where Tribe, De La Soul, like where all of those artists would go and hang out. Mm. And it must have just been a different time where like you could just go and hang out with the artists that you were listening to, because around this time you might have actually met my parents. I might have.
That's why I'm doing that. So I'm not using any names, because I'm like, there's definitely some.
Yeah, I feel like I'm saying real quiet.
Yeah, yeah. I might have actually been at one of your concerts in the womb.
It's mad. Like honestly, I think this is why it amazes me and it intrigues me so much, because the stories that you're talking about right now, and I just sit there and listen when my aunties and my uncles go into it, because my uncle told a story once where he was in McDonald's with Snoop Dogg, because him and Snoop were the only two in their group that were too young to get into a club they were going to, but NWA were over here, and I'm like, it's just wild, because that kind of stuff would never ever happen now. Yeah. Never ever happen now, and it's like, that is when hip hop was really becoming what it is today.
Yeah.
And it was so approachable. I'm kind of glad for the artist's sake that it's not so much like that now.
And they were so just normal. I've told you before, like there was a day where I was hanging out with Onyx. I don't even remember Onyx. And I just remember thinking, I must have wound him up all day, but I was like, but why are you called Sticky Fingers?
I was about to say, was that the Sticky Fingers?
Yeah, but I was like, but why are you called Sticky Fingers?
I am sitting now with Sticky Fingers. But the thing is,
He was just cool with it. Like I remember, because I was very fortunate to have met quite a lot of artists in the 90s, and like I remember first person I ever heard swear was Naina Cherry. Naina Cherry was doing a concert and was late onto the stage, and I was just sitting in the green room. It was like a little you. She was like, "Oh, do you have the time?" I was like, "Oh, it's this," and she just went, "Oh shit!" It just dipped. But it's like, it was such a norm. Like nowadays, an artist could, well, if they're going to be late, it's because they're being fashionable and da da da. But she was like, no, I have to be on time and deliver my stuff, because it hadn't been made yet. And I think we were all fortunate. If you kind of, we saw it happen with, we didn't see it with hip hop, but we saw it with like Garage and Grime. Like, I remember seeing some of these guys, they used to come to our basketball games. Because I used to play basketball in Whitechapel. And so it was like, they'd always come to the East London Hackney games. And you just be like, oh, so when you, and then I remember Boy in the Corner got released and everybody was like, this is massive. I was like, what, him? Like, nah, he supports the other team, but they don't even like him. And then you go, oh no, they're winning big awards. So like, it must've been great for you to be this. And it's something that you've talked about and it keeps coming through, is like, you're restless, and that puts you in a position to keep being at the cutting edge of stuff. And I guess my question is, what's the last thing that you really felt on the cutting edge of?
I certainly couldn't answer that question if it got asked me.
I mean, I definitely feel like I'm the least cool person now.
Well, that's just wrong.
Everything that you've been saying so far.
What's the last thing I was on the cutting edge of? Oh, I don't know. Well, I will say that in my work life, you know, I worked for a very popular national newspaper website. And I was the showbiz editor there. And, you know, I have a daughter, and she was probably about 12 then. And she's like a big music fan. And she used to listen to, obviously, Grime. So I knew about people like Giggs and Skepta and stuff like that. And it actually used to tickle me to put stories about them on the website. First of all, no, they didn't know who they were.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I knew who they were. So if I saw there was a little something there, or if there was a picture of them even, I would put a picture of them on the story. Mm. And I mean, you look at Skepta now.
Yeah.
You look at Giggs now, like, I'm not saying I'm responsible for it.
I'm not.
But what I'm saying is, I feel like I contributed
yeah.
in a small way.
Yeah.
To
normalizing as well.
To just including them
100%
in the showbiz world, because before that people weren't talking about those guys, people were not writing about them, not mainstream. I mean obviously the streets knew, but not mainstream. And she told me about Drake. She was playing Drake's music and I was like, okay. Then a gig came up and he did his first gig at Hammersmith. Was it Hammersmith Odeon? Apollo? I think I'm like getting confused now. No, but he did a very small, Shepherd's Bush Empire. I think he did a very small gig. But there, a lot of the footballers came out.
Yeah.
Lots of the celebs came out. So when we were doing the conference the next day, my editor's like, "Oh, who's this?" I said, "Oh, it's this rapper Drake." He's like, "Should we be covering it?" I'm like, "Yes, absolutely, we should be covering it." And then, you know, that's if I hadn't been in that room, it probably would have gone a few months longer, you know, before anybody would have thought to say, "Oh, we should probably write about this guy."
Yeah.
And I told the LA office as well, "You need to start writing about this guy." And they thought I was saying that because I fancied him. I'm like, no, I don't fancy him, but he's going to be big.
Yeah. Mm.
And the last place I worked at, which was 2 years ago now, the place I got made redundant from, it was a showbiz news agency. And my daughter showed me a video of Cardi B doing Bodak Yellow. Nice. Live in New York. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I heard it, I said, this tune's going to be massive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How comes I'm only just seeing this now? Mm-hmm. Who is she? Well, I knew who she was because she was on
Love and Hip Hop.
Yeah. And when I went into work on Monday, I said, we need to start writing about Cardi B. And then the next one was Megan. I said,
of course.
I said, Megan. So, yeah.
So you are on the cutting.
So
I think I'm still there. I guess I am.
I'm still there. These people need to be cutting you checks, basically. Yeah.
But in all seriousness, they do, though, because the publications that you worked at is the sort of gateway from the streets to random. Like, I've worked in public schools, like independent schools a lot, and you'll have kids coming up to me going like, you don't know about, you know, what do you know about Skepta? Like saying it exactly like that as well. And it's like, but it's literally what you were doing would have been the gateway, because I'm pretty sure they weren't listening to, like, you know, the music stations that we were listening to. They weren't listening to Channel U. Do you know what I mean?
Like Prince FM and that.
F radio then, you know, so I actually do think that when you're trying to be humble with it, but it's like, you were the gateway to the mainstream. And then it's that thing of like, oh, if you can get kind of certain kind of people kind of nodding their head, you know, the way that Jay-Z did when he heard that tune from Timbaland, you know, that I do actually think that's real cutting edge. Dom, Alana, what's the last cutting edge thing you guys did? Top that.
An Iron Man?
Oh, yeah. No,
next question.
Yeah. Did Jimmy and you just slid down?
It's important, though, because we said it. The world is told by black faces in white spaces, and we're not necessarily saying that you need to be black to be into these kind of cultures and into the music, etc. But it's important to have people like you in these rooms, in these conversations.
Mm. I mean, I think when people like us are in these rooms, it just, you do get something from it, something really good, something special can come from it. It's boring to have just one viewpoint all the time. And I think that's another reason why, you know, my cycling journey has kind of also given me a profile, because I've got something new to say, or I'm somebody new saying it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I always say to other women, share your journeys, share your what you're doing, your activities, because other women want to see it. Like, we can't have men speaking for us in that space.
Yep.
We have to speak for us. You know, we have to speak for black women. Or, you know, I don't want to speak for all black women, but I want to add my voice to the conversation, because it's important to have diversity of conversation, of thoughts. And we're here, we're in this, we're involved in this community, in this activity, and our voices should carry as much weight as anybody else's.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I have a bonus question before we start to wrap up.
Okay.
Obviously, in the last, what, probably 6-7 months, De La Soul finally got their tunes onto sharing platforms.
Yes.
Obviously, that means there's a lot of people that are going to be hearing De La Soul's music for the first time. If we take away De La Soul, what's one artist from that era that you think doesn't necessarily get the respect or airtime that they should do in 2024?
I would say Gangstar.
Yes! Yes! Yes!
Very good. Very, very
they
good.
They need to yes. have a renaissance.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I might have just blown your ear. I'm so sorry.
I don't know, that yes. just came instantly to me and I knew him well. Yeah.
Moment of Truth is one of, well, you know how I feel about it. The first album I ever bought with my own money, as in money that I had specifically earned, was the 10-year. Then I went back and bought Moment of Truth. I used to dominate the speaker before the basketball matches. So the tune that we would always come out to is Work. Yes.
Above the Clouds is the one for me.
But if you're a basketball player, there's nothing more gangster than waiting to hearing, are you working? What kind of work do you do? And then busting through on that first note. I'm so sorry.
He made some beautiful original music, and the rap star, obviously
Jazzmatazz.
Premier was the producer.
Yeah.
And he, you know, it wasn't like he was just saying whatever.
Yeah.
He had flow. He had bars.
Yeah. Guru's whole Jazzmatazz, man. He was unbelievable.
Mass Appeal.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you said Gangsta.
I'm glad I said
Yeah, he's an absolute classic. And when I was at this website, I wrote the story when he died.
Was that 2007?
I can't remember what year it was.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
It's been a while. It's been a while. Yeah.
It's so sad. But, you know, in a way, for me, it felt good that I was the person doing it, because obviously I knew him, I knew his music, and I always wanted to honor those people. Like Tina Marie wrote stories about her. I would always do those stories because you want to give them a certain amount of care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it's just so ironic that I ended up in that place.
Yeah.
Being able to do that.
And the sad thing is with kind of hip hop, so many of those stories have had to be written for people that died far too soon. I remember the one that I was like, oh, because all of them hurt, but there's always one that hurts more. For me, it was Jam Master Jay.
Yeah.
I just remember I was like, because the thing is, it's like, even as a youngster, I'd be like, some of them, like, it's not like it's all tragic, but at least if they're kind of talking about a specific lifestyle, you can understand why it happens. Jam Master Jay wasn't talking that. And I just remember that one really. So I'm really pleased that somebody from the culture was able to kind of actually. So sometimes I think that people don't understand how important some people are. Like the lead singer of Morgan Heritage just passed.
Yeah.
And I'm
Lisa
really.
Morgan.
No, I know it really. It sounds like a really strange thing, but I'm really hoping that if it's written about in the UK press, that Nadine White writes about it, because Nadine White is Britain's only race correspondent and a Jamaican, and somebody that knew him personally will be able to explain to the masses, this is why this person matters.
I think as well, on top of that, and this is kind of the circular nature of this chat, so I think back to Dave from De La Soul when he passed away last year, just before their music hit the DSPs, and it's like, it's so sad that you're not able to see this whole new generation of people discover your music for the first time.
Yeah.
Like, even if you take away the financial aspect of it, like, that's like a real renaissance moment for you and your artistry. Bringing it back around to what you do and what we're all talking about here with the fitness and black people being much more active, I really hope that this, in a couple of generations' time, leads to us losing less of these people way too soon. Mm. Way too soon, because it's inspiring to see people that are in their 50s, 60s, 70s and they're still so active. Mm-hmm. It's very rare, in my experience at least anyway, that that person looks like me. Mm-hmm. So I'm just hoping that the more we see of that, the more people we see doing amazing things like you, Donna, the more people we don't have to say goodbye to far too soon, honestly, because it's awful.
Absolutely. I think Method Man is setting a really good example. Yes. Oh, I regularly check his Instagram for his updates on his fitness.
Meth's looking all right, isn't he? He's looking all right. Yeah.
Aging well.
He's setting the pace. He's setting the pace. And I think he definitely will influence a lot of the guys to keep it going.
Absolutely.
Yeah. More black health, more black wealth, well-being. Community, all the things.
Bikes.
More bikes. More bikes for black people. Yeah. More cycling gangs, chain gangs. And Donna, thank you so much for being here. I feel like we barely scratched the surface, so maybe we could get you on another time as well. But thank you so much.
Thank you for being you, because you might normalize all this because it's your life, but it is not only impressive, it's inspiring. So thank you for everything that you do for the culture. So
true inspiration. Yeah, thank you. Genuinely,
I enjoyed it.
But your daughter's just so tight. Yeah, I came. Yeah, they said I was an inspiration. Listen to these people. You should listen to them.
Perfect. No, thanks, everyone.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, we are out.